The next time you bite into that juicy burger or into that piece of chicken or pork chop or a steak or whatever, you might want to think a little bit about where it came from. Modern technology has made farming incredibly efficient, but now a study confirms there's a global impact regarding meat production. We'll talk about what changes need to occur to protect the environment this morning on the Joy Cardine program. Good morning, I'm John Munson, in for Joy Cardine. My guest this hour is Brian Walsh, senior editor at Time Magazine, the author of the story, The Triple Whopper: Environmental Impact of Global Meat Production. Brian Walsh, welcome to the Joy Cardine program.
Hi, it's good to be here.
So that's an interesting headline. Those of us who've been to Burger King got the joke. What is the Triple Whopper impact of global meat production?
Well, I think really it's just, you know, it's a reminder of just how large an effect meat production has on the environment in a lot of different ways. I mean, for one thing, just farming and not just the sort of space required to raise, whether it's pigs, poultry, cattle, takes up a lot of the planet. And then, of course, you need the land to grow the feed to feed them. So there's that fact. But then there's also the energy that goes into that whole process, which is a major impact on the planet, a major impact on greenhouse gas emissions. There are the actual emissions of the animals themselves, especially when it comes to cattle. You have a lot of methane coming from the cattle that has an impact on the environment in terms of warming. But it's just really sort of a reminder, I think, of the fact that when you're trying to raise enough food, especially meat, because meat is so much more intensive than vegetables and other forms of food, for 7 billion people, and a lot of them are like Americans where you're eating a lot of meat, that's going to have a huge, huge impact. I mean, we look and we see power plants, coal plants, what have you, we see cars. We can kind of, sort of visualize very easily the impact that has on the environment. We see the emissions, we see the gas that we're buying. We sometimes forget that behind dinner, behind breakfast, behind lunch, there's a big impact on the planet as well. And as there are more and more of us on the earth, and as more and more of us want to eat more, as more people in the rest of the world may want to eat like Americans, that impact is going to go up unless we can find a way to really do what the authors of this paper call sort of a sustainable intensification, getting more efficient, but also trying to limit the sort of bad effects that can sometimes come from efficiency.
Yeah, reading the report that you talk about, it reminds me of one of those old that's good, that's bad stories. You're talking about, okay, livestock can contribute valuable nutrients for crops, but also be responsible for nutrient pollution and land degradation. They provide critically important protein and micronutrients. Gosh, I can't even say that word at 6 o'clock in the morning. But they also contribute to obesity. So, I mean, there are a lot of what the report calls dualities here. I guess the thing that really struck me, and because we don't think about this when we sit down to dinner, is that compared to the rest of the world, we in America, man, we eat a lot more meat than everybody else.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, you're talking about Americans eating, I believe something over 80 pounds of meat a day. A lot of it, a year. A lot of it coming from beef, which is much more comparatively rare in the rest of the world. And that's continued to go up for the most part in the U.S. I mean, you've seen some changes, I think, in the composition of the meat in the diet. I think beef has sort of slowed a bit. You've seen maybe more chicken as people become perhaps a bit more health conscious. But yeah, I mean, if you had every person in the world eat the same amount of meat as Americans, I mean, it would just be incredibly difficult to simply raise enough. I mean, the space that would be required, the energy that would be required would be very difficult. And, on one hand, when you look in sort of rising countries, China definitely comes to mind, places like India, even places like, Africa, which is growing quite rapidly. People tend to, one of the first things they do as they get a little bit more money, as they get a little more security, is they do tend to eat more meat. They change their diets. And we really haven't seen too many examples where that's not the case. So as the global economy continues to grow, which, is obviously a good thing, you want people to get out of poverty. You want them to have a more varied diet. Protein makes a big difference, especially early on in the diet. Then you have to think about how you're going to produce that. And that's especially a concern, I think, as this report sort of goes into detail, that when you look at how meat is produced in the rest of the world, in the developing world, then you've got to be concerned because It's much less efficient. And if, you know, on one hand, that means there is a lot of space for improvement there. On the other hand, it means if you don't have that improvement, you're really going to potentially have a lot of local impacts and also global impacts from that change.
Well, let's talk about that difference, because as much criticism as the quote-unquote factory farms get in the United States, they are incredibly efficient at producing what we want on the table, which is meat and more of it. Let's talk about the differences in production between what we have here in the United States and exist in other developed countries, and, for example, what meat production is like in sub-Saharan Africa.
Right. I mean, in sub-Saharan Africa, you know, so let's take North America, Europe, and places where you know, you have that sort of more factory kind of setup for it. You know, a cow might consume, 75 kilograms, 300 kilograms of grass or grain to produce, a kilogram of protein. In sub-Saharan Africa, you need, more than five times that much sometimes to do the same. And that's because you're getting usually very poor feed quality for those animals, and they often also, you have very high mortality rates, so you need to feed a lot of cattle, but many of those cattle won't actually make it to the table. So that's a problem, and that also goes back to the quality of farming in those countries, where you don't have, access to fertilizers, you don't have access to sort of chemicals which do help reduce the cost and increase the effectiveness of growing food. So you also, that need for more feed, that need for more space as well. You know, often of course when we say factory farms, what environmentalists especially have a major problem with, I think, is the fact you have a lot of animals packed very closely. But of course, I mean, just that sort of would create an efficiency if you were talking about any other kind of product. It does create an efficiency when it comes to space. Whereas again, if you go to, sub-Saharan Africa is the place that's often focused here, but even in, richer developing world countries like Brazil, you need a lot more space per cattle, to grow. And that means, that can have some impacts on something like deforestation when it comes to the loss of the Amazon rainforest, for instance. A lot of that land is being converted from rainforest to pasture land. And if you're not very efficient in the amount of pasture land you need to raise per cattle, that means more deforestation, that means more greenhouse gas emissions, and it means, the destruction of an incredibly important part of the Earth's environment.
And the other one of the other things that this report points out is the difference in terms of greenhouse gases depending on what the cattle are eating. Can we talk about that for a little bit?
Right. I mean, it seems as if, when you're talking about more and more grass, I think that actually can lead to higher amounts of greenhouse gas emissions. Again, a lot of it's very interesting to look at because it's such a sort of chain reaction process. If you clear forest land to create pasture land for cows, you're going to increase the amount of greenhouse gas emissions, not only in the sense that you're losing forest, but also in the sense that that's going to be often less efficient. But if you're looking to go for a more grain-based diet, which is one of the reasons why pigs and poultry are much more efficient per kilogram or per pound when it comes to raising food for greenhouse gas emissions, you're looking at lower emissions. So, it's not just whether we eat meat or how much meat we eat. It's often what kind of meat we eat as well as how it's actually produced.
We're talking about the environmental impact of global meat production today on the Joy Cardine program. Wondering what you think about this. How can we improve global meat production? In what ways do you think global meat production affects the environment? And is this an important issue, or maybe you think it's overblown? Well, let's chat about it. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. It's a toll-free number. It's good pretty much anywhere you can hear the program. You can also send an email to talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org, or look for The Joy Cardine Show on Facebook and leave your comment or question there. Talking with Brian Walsh, senior editor at Time Magazine, the author of the story, The Triple Whopper: Environmental Impact of Global Meat Production. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. So modern technology has made farming more efficient, but a new study confirms a global impact of meat production. We're talking about that this hour with Brian Walsh, senior editor at Time Magazine, who wrote the story, The Triple Whopper: Environmental Impact of Global Meat Production. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine this morning on the Ideas Network. 800-642-1234, the number to call to join the program and talk about this issue. this morning on the Ideas Network. There's a line I want to read from the kind of the abstract of the research report that you cite in your article, Brian Walsh. It says, there is growing recognition that improving the environmental performance of livestock systems as well as establishing sustainable levels of consumption of animal-sourced foods are essential for the sustainability of the global food system. That sounds like an awfully tall order.
Oh, it's a very tall order, I think, you know, and on both sides. In terms of the supply side, you have to look both at, you know, how you might be producing it, even in the most efficient countries like the United States. But you also have to think about how you can do it in those developing nations that are very poor. It's not, you know, it's not just inefficient in a place like Sub-Saharan Africa because people aren't good farmers. It's because there are limitations on development, limitations on infrastructure, limitations simply on poverty that make it very difficult to raise food. So that's one issue. And on one hand, that's a huge opportunity for improvement. There are a lot of people working on that. On the other hand, it's proven very difficult. Then on the consumption side, you know, we environmentalists and a lot of people talk often about, oh, we need to think about demand side, you know, being the kind of food we eat. But that's often proven very difficult. You know, I mean, people like to eat meat. Americans certainly like to eat meat, but so do people around the world. And, you know, how you actually go about modulating that demand is extremely challenging. I mean, some people use levers of health, you know, saying, well, it's more healthy to reduce the amount of meat in your diet. You've seen, I think, some phenomena like the meatless Mondays that are sort of happening around the United States. But you know, it's hard. I mean, it's hard just as it is to get people to say, limit their energy use, limit driving, things like that. Generally, we don't respond that well to those kinds of limits. And then when you go on top of that and you say, all right, you, the 2 billion people in the developing world who are now getting to the point where you can afford meat, to tell them that they should eat less is, you know, frankly, kind of unfair given that people in the developed world have kind of had the lion's share of those resources for quite a long time.
We've got some Facebook comments I'd like to share. We have a listener who writes on Facebook, as long as meat consumption remains high, there is no use trying to grow it sustainably. It can't be done. The laws of physics. It takes 10 times more land area to grow meat than to grow vegetable-based foods. So, I mean, is this just the no-win scenario? If we're going to keep eating meat, we have to accept its inefficiency?
Well, I definitely hope not. I mean, there are ways that we may have to respond to that. I mean, it could be as demand goes up and up, just like any other commodity, the price may go up. That may cause people to change the economy they eat, whether it's here in the U.S. or in the rest of the world. We've seen that just in the, I mean, oil is, I think, a very good example for that. Oil used to be incredibly cheap around the world. Now, of course, even as we produce more oil because the demand is so high, the price is sitting up there around $100 a barrel. I don't think that's going to happen with meat. We've been very good at responding to this. You could see like that, something like that happening in the future. Because we're, you know, we're projected now to go to something like 9 billion people, perhaps, by the middle of the century. And chances are those people will be richer than they are now. So, you know, we'll most likely find a way. I mean, farmers, certainly in the developed world here in the United States, have proven incredibly successful when it comes to meeting that demand. I mean, it's amazing to me, even in a period like 2012, in the U.S., where much of the country was hit by a pretty major drought, you know, you did see yields for crops like corn go down. But then you compare a year like 2012, just even in the middle of the 80s, on a good year, yield was still better on a per acre basis. I mean, that shows just how effective farmers have become in meeting that demand. So, you know, we'll do it. The question is, will we figure out a way to price out the externalities? I mean, will we, whether it's the same way maybe we've time to put some limits, or in the future we'll put limits on energy production for greenhouse gas emissions. Will you try to extend those to farming? I think that's going to be very challenging because it's so hidden. You know, you, again, like I said, you see the emissions from a coal plant, you see the emissions from a car, but you don't really see it for a farm. It's kind of out of sight, out of mind. So that might need to change to really get that effect.
Well, John on Facebook writes, I think about it. Sadly, I don't do much or anything about it. Cheap meat is a hard habit to kick. It's like, who wanted to be the first person to quit smoking or the first people to start recycling? Is Meatless Monday really enough? I mean, how many days a week would it take to make a difference in our meat consumption?
Well, I think if you saw the entire country adopt a Meatless Monday, that would make a big difference. I think I had the wrong number about the amount of meat Americans eat. It's actually 270 pounds of meat a year, so even just one day of dropping back, or even just one meal would make a difference if you added that over more than 300 million people. And if you saw that going globally as well, that could make a big difference. I mean, I don't want to say that it's not possible for us to do that. You know, I think we can change. I mean, you know, the person mentioned smoking. That's changed amazingly. I mean, you go 50 years ago, people were smoking everywhere. They were smoking in airplanes. They were smoking in offices. That changed, you know, both because we saw very clear health effects, but we also passed laws, you know, that made that suddenly, you know, both not as legal as it used to be, but also we kind of changed the way society looked at that. It's a little harder to imagine that with me because it is so ingrained. I mean, you know, people like meat so much. We have huge companies based around the sort of cheap, easy production, also selling of meat. But, you know, I mean, it's entirely possible that could change in the future. Maybe it comes not from climate change in the environment. Maybe it comes from something like animal welfare. You know, we may look back 50 years from the future and say, well, how are we ever doing that? So, you know, humans can change. The planet can change. We are amazingly adaptable. It's just, you know, that person is absolutely right. It is really difficult.
Well, in the United States, we have cheap food generally compared to a lot of other places. But isn't one of the reasons for that government policies that subsidize agriculture? And I'm not saying those are good or bad, but I mean, it is what it is. If those subsidies disappeared, the price of food in general would increase dramatically, wouldn't it?
I think that's absolutely true. You know, we if you go back 50, 60, 70 years ago, the average American was spending a much higher percentage of their income on food. That's dropped significantly, you know, and that's a good thing in terms of just for people. I mean, you don't want to be spending more money necessarily in your food, but that is a consequence of the subsidies you mentioned, really a government policy over the last number of decades to produce more and more grain, which, of course, then makes it easier and cheaper to produce that meat as well. You know, we could change that. We could try to bring that more into line with the actual cost, both economically and environmentally, of that. But it's tough. Once you have a subsidy like that, it's so ingrained in the way the economy functions, it's very hard to change that. I mean, because it becomes the norm. And you can see it'd be very difficult to get, I think, farming states, for instance, to accept those changes. And attempts to shift that have been very challenging. You know, at the same time, we've seen how difficult it's been to get a farm bill going through Congress. That used to be something that was fairly easy, and now, like a lot of other things in Congress, it's becoming very hard. So I do wonder in the future whether that might shift. But right now, I don't really get the sense that, you know, when it comes to the you know, Americans as a whole, that's an issue they're really all that aware of. So it would need to change, but at the same time, politically, it'd be very challenging to change.
We have a caller joining us from Sawyer, Minnesota. Linda is on the line. Linda, good morning.
Good morning. I was just calling because I heard that because of the temperature and stuff the past year or so, because of the droughts we've had, and then because of the big snow of South Dakota and North Dakota this fall, that production of cattle is down to what it was in the 50s and that the price of meat is going up really high.
Well, I have noticed a jump in the price of beef in the supermarket in the last few weeks.
Yeah, I think that is something that could have an effect down the line. You know, when you have a big event like that, and that was such a freak event, that South Dakota freeze, when you have sort of a drought or anything like that that can affect production, that's going to be felt down the line. But you know, it is sort of amazing in the United States, and it's a tribute, I think, to how effective the system is, at least when it comes to producing, that we're much more resilient to any of those sort of events than we would have been in the past. You know, again, like 50, 60 years ago, if you had a big event like that, a drought, you know, a major freeze, it would have had a huge impact, I think, on the price. Now, because that system, you know, there's frankly so much excess built into that system, you're more resilient to that. So you may see an increase in the price of meat, but, you know, I think you will, but it's not going to be the kind of crippling price it might have been in those decades past, again, because we simply are spending so much less of our income on meat. So it's hard to see, for me at least, in America, where, you know, the cost itself is going to be really the defining factor. I think if you're talking about what will make people eat less meat, it's probably going to be more likely some other thing, that whether it's a change in consciousness, a change in taste habits, you know, maybe a spread in sort of a quasi-vegetarianism, those things might happen. You see some studies indicate that among younger people, vegetarian or sort of lower meat diets are becoming, I think, more popular. Maybe that's the way it shifts.
I wonder how much of this, I guess where we're going with this, some of this is cultural, and maybe even some of the differences in consumption between America and other places in the world. Some of this, isn't some of this cultural? Our culture is just different. We eat more meat?
Absolutely. You know, I mean, you know, at place, you may have places in the world where, for instance, in India, there's cultural prohibition against eating a lot of beef. Although even there, in a country with hundreds of millions of Hindu people, you are seeing an increase in beef consumption as people get richer. But clearly, you know, meat has such a central part of the American diet. And I don't just mean, you know, McDonald's, Burger King. You know, I mentioned the Triple Whopper in the headline of the story. You know, we certainly, whether it's fetishized or meat, you know, it's just part of the diet on almost every given meal. I mean,
meat and potatoes. Got to have meat and potatoes.
Exactly. That's meat and potatoes.
Yeah.
The hamburger for lunch, you know.
Right.
The chicken porridge for dinner. All those things, I think, really, really are central to it in a way that it really hasn't been in the rest of the world. But it's in the rest of the world where that change is going to be happening even more rapidly, you know, where economic growth simply seems to lead to more meat consumption. So it may be actually in places where it hasn't happened yet, maybe that's where you can kind of make that shift, where people aren't used to meat as a central part of their diet. Maybe that's where you can kind of slow that down.
Brian, we're at news time. We're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to continue to talk about that theme a little bit, some of the shifting that we're seeing as some areas of the world become more prosperous. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thirty percent of the world's ice-free surface is used to support the chickens, pigs, and cattle that eventually land on our kitchen tables. And livestock production uses up to one-third of the world's fresh water. Major environmental impacts, major cultural issues, questions about the sustainability of our diets as world population continues to increase. We're talking about all of that this morning with Brian Walsh, senior editor at Time Magazine, who wrote the article, The Triple Whopper Environmental Impact of Global Meat Production. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine here on the Ideas Network. If you'd like to join our discussion, please, we welcome your comments and questions. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Put down that cup of coffee and pick up the phone and give us a call. Or you can send an email to talk@WPR.org or find us on Facebook. Look for the Joy Cardine Show and leave your comment or question there, as several people already have this morning. Well, Brian, before the news, we were kind of talking about some of the economics of agriculture in general, and some of the cultural differences in terms of, you know, where meat is consumed a lot, like in the United States, and where it isn't. But you know, I guess, you know, we all like our meat and potatoes. That's part of American culture and has been for centuries. Part of that may have been, I mean, we take for granted that we have fresh vegetables all year long, thanks to modern transportation methods that get things to market from places where they can grow them to places like where I'm sitting, where it's below zero this morning. We take that for granted, but that hasn't always been the case. It's really only been, in the last 75 years or so that we've had access to a lot of this. So for a lot of people, meat and potatoes was the only thing they could put on the table at this latitude, because that's what's stored.
That's absolutely true. You know, and you know, we sometimes forget about the way those kind of technological changes can have a big impact on what we eat, how we eat as well. You know, you mentioned, I mean, something like fish. I mean, the idea that we can now flash freeze fish, ship that around the world, then suddenly you can get, you know, ocean fish into a place like Wisconsin any time of the year. That wasn't possible, I think, decades ago as well. And so we really have a cornucopia of food to eat anywhere here in the United States, and also really anywhere in rich countries. That's kind of amazing. So we now have choices that we didn't have before. And I guess you could also look at that, it comes with some responsibility as well. Now that we have both the economic means and the technological means to really choose our diet, it's sort of up to us what we want that diet to be, both for our own health and maybe also thinking as well for the planet's health too.
Also, since the title of your article is it talks about environmental impacts of global meat production, we did touch on that a little bit in the first half of the program, but I think we need to spend a little more time on it. There are a lot of different impacts. So if you have a big factory farm, well, you've got a lot of waste in a concentrated area. That can be a major problem. We talked about greenhouse gas emissions. We talked about the the deforestation that is involved in creating new pasture land. I guess if you add if you take each of those as an individual, it doesn't seem maybe quite as large as if you take the entire industry of food production in the aggregate and take a look at it. Is there anything else that human beings do on the planet that has a bigger environmental impact than agriculture?
Ultimately, I don't think so. I mean, you know, to take something like carbon emissions or greenhouse gas emissions as a sort of proxy, given how big an impact that has on the planet, you know, you've seen different stats on this. I mean, there was a UN report that came out in the middle of the last decade that said that, you know, the global livestock industry was responsible for about 18% of total greenhouse gas emissions. You know, and then there are other studies that come out more recently that peg the number quite higher. You know, once you add up all those land use changes, which are a big impact as you get rid of forests and turn them into farms, that's a big increase in greenhouse gas emissions. As you think about all the energy required to really make the modern farming industry go, that's a lot more carbon emissions as well. You know, so it's hard to really figure that out, but I don't really think anything else does have quite that impact when you add it all up. When you think about that transportation to get those fresh vegetables or that fish or that hamburger patty from the producer to the consumer around the world, that's really impacting. And even if you look at the planet from space, in many ways, you know, the Earth is a one giant farm that's occasionally broken up by cities and settlements and, you know, some forests that are still around and also deserts and ice. But really, when it comes to habitable lands, we've needed to change most of that or much of that to farms. And that's probably the biggest single change of the land that this species has really done.
800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Lines available for you if you want to call right now. Talk at WPR.org or leave a comment or question on Facebook. Brian Walsh is my guest this hour, senior editor at Time Magazine, author of the article, The Triple Whopper Environmental Impact of Global Meat Production. Wondering what you think about this. Do you have ideas about how we might improve meat production or ways that innovations we could make that perhaps we could reduce meat production if you think that's what we should do? How do you look at the way global meat production affects the environment? And maybe a better question is, do you think about that? Does that impact the way you shop and the way you feed yourself and your family? Do you consider these things when you go to the market, for example? Have your eating habits changed over time? And do you think this is an important issue, or maybe you're not worried about it quite as much? Room for all of those opinions and questions and more here on the Ideas Network at 800-642-1234. Let's take a call. We'll go to Matt in Oshkosh. Matt, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Yes, good morning. I want you to know that I'm feeding cows right now. And I have a question for your guests. Before this country was settled, there were more free-roaming buffalo on the plains of this country than there are cattle in total right now. There were by a couple of hundred million head. Why now do we have a problem if the population of the buffalo 300 years ago was that much greater than what we're dealing with right now?
Matt, thanks for the question. Brian Walsh?
That's a very interesting question. Honestly, it's one I hadn't really considered before. I definitely know, you know, the number of buffalo was simply vast, and you have these reports from, you know, before the death of the buffalo, of just the herds, the sort of plains being just black with the buffalo. I would wonder, you know, I mean, I don't know how different when it comes to the sort of emissions that a buffalo might produce, what their diet would be, whether that would have an impact. Of course, you didn't have the sort of industrial system of slaughtering them, shipping them around the country, those sort of things that certainly do add to the impact of reproduction now. But I don't know. You know, it's interesting to note that what things would have been like in the past. We certainly know that the population of human beings was much less, so that would have, I think, an impact as well. And, you know, you didn't have the sort of raising of those animals and then the slaughtering of them repeatedly over and over again the way we do now with modern farm animals. But, you know, for me, it's the real driver here. We've been talking about pigs, cattle, and chickens, but the real driver actually is the human beings and the number of human beings because of what they need. It's not just that we're not creating all this farmland for the heck of it. We're doing it to feed this growing global population and a population that's going to add another 2 billion people in the future, 2 billion people who are going to want, I think, that meat. So that's where things are going, and I think that's the huge challenge. It's not as if we're not singling out the livestock sector as if it's something bad. Rather, this is just part and parcel of what we've been able to do to create the society we have. So now we're just sort of catching our breath, maybe looking at what the impact of that is and thinking about, well, are there ways to sort of change that or modulate that to make it better for the planet or more sustainable for the long term, I think.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll continue our discussion with Brian Walsh about the impact of global meat production on our environment. Brian wrote an article titled "The Triple Whopper: Environmental Impact of Global Meat Production." Gosh, I read that and I got hungry. I don't know why. He's a senior editor at Time Magazine. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. You're welcome to join us on the Ideas Network at 800-642-1234. We've got some calls. We've got some Facebook comments. We'll get to all of that and more in just a bit. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Takes up a lot of land, uses up a lot of water, but feeds 7 billion people. It's a conundrum. What do we do? Brian Walsh is my guest today on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. Brian, a senior editor at Time Magazine, wrote the story, "The Triple Whopper: Environmental Impact of Global Meat Production." We're talking about that this morning. You're welcome to join us at 800-642-1234, talk at WPR.org, or on Facebook. David writes on Facebook. He says, "It's birds and fish only for me. No beef or pork for David." Well, I guess that's one way to go about it. And another listener writes, "I'm a recovering meat eater. It is so sad what is happening in meat production. Buy local as much as possible. Maybe incorporate a meatless meal once a week. Know where your food comes from and the process used to make it." Well, a lot of people are paying more attention to buying locally and things like that. How much of an impact can that really have, though, Brian?
I think that can have more of an impact whether it's buying local. Certainly buying local has an impact economically for local areas and for local farmers and for connecting farmers to their consumers. I think that's very important. When it comes to the environmental impact, I mean, if you're talking about organic meat, perhaps, or grass-raised beef, you might have a lower impact altogether, again, locally. But, you know, if you're still eating the same amount of meat, it's still going to be creating a pretty big environmental impact. I think if you're simply interested in trying to reduce that globally, you want to kind of just try to modulate the meat consumption as much as possible. And certainly, given the amount of meat Americans eat, there's a lot of room you could do to modulate that while still eating, I think, quite a lot.
So, you know, as we talk about maybe working towards some solutions for this, we've been talking about the problem pretty much the entire hour. Let's spend the rest of the program maybe talking about some of the solutions. Is there where is this on the radar in terms of how governments internationally talk about these issues? Or is there a real movement to try to see some changes in the way things are done? And, you know, I mean, I guess some problems just really don't have solutions. It's not like there is any magic wand or fairy dust or anything like that. What do we do and what's happening in the world today to maybe try to move us toward solving these problems?
Well, it's important also, remember, when we talk about the problems, that while we've been focusing on the environmental impact, you know, there's more than a billion undernourished people on the planet today. And those are people who need more food. And really, they also need more protein, more meat as well. So you do see governments, you see big NGOs, I mean, someone as smart as Bill Gates, working on the idea of how do we improve farming practices in those poor countries. Those are the places where it's least efficient, as we mentioned at the beginning of the program. And because it's least efficient, that also means there's a lot of room to improve. So I think, you know, the focus really should be, how do you improve those farmers, say, again, in sub-Saharan Africa? How do you improve them in places like Eastern Europe or the Ukraine, where, you know, these are not incredibly poor countries, but when it comes to the efficiency, they're far less efficient than a farmer, you know, in Wisconsin or in Iowa. So if you can improve that efficiency, you can get more calories out to people, which is incredibly important. And also, I think without really necessarily having the same, quite the same impact on the environment, if you could say reduce the amount of space you need per cattle or the amount of feed you need per cattle. So that's one solution. And then when it comes to the sort of bigger question, I mean, there's a lot of far out ideas out there. One thing we haven't talked about is this movement potentially towards in vitro meat, this idea that you may end up in the future growing your meats in labs, which is beginning to happen. I mean, only on the sort of experimental basis, but you could imagine perhaps in the future where you don't need that amount of land, you don't need that amount of grain. You can maybe even grow that meat in a tank, do it incredibly efficiently, more efficient without the sort of negative impacts. But of course, A, you have to be able to do that, do it cheaply, which is going to be challenging. And B, you have to convince people that they could actually eat, say, a lab-grown hamburger, a lab-grown chicken strips, or what have you. And that's something that might be a lot more challenging, even than getting them to perhaps eat less meat.
What about the idea of distributing surplus meat to those regions that need protein?
I mean, that's definitely something to do. I mean, we already do that to a huge degree with food aid. I think that's more challenging because it's a lot easier to ship grain or even some vegetables and fruits to other parts of the world than to ship beef. But, you know, at the same time, what you really want to do, not necessarily is ship, say, the excess from here, but you want to build up farmers in those parts of the developing world. I mean, it's interesting. For a farmer, say, in sub-Saharan Africa, livestock is incredibly important. For them, a cow or chicken or poultry, they're like a walking bank. I mean, that's where they can sort of invest whatever excess income they have. And, you know, what we need to do is help them, you know, help them reduce the mortality rate of those herds, because that helps them economically, that helps them support themselves. So I think first and foremost, you want to think about how do you help those people in those parts of the world. And that's an incredibly challenging question. If you're talking about, you know, global development, you're talking about the incredibly difficult process of global poverty. But that's really something where if you can help them help themselves, I think that's the best solution altogether.
Well, one of the conundrums, for example, in sub-Saharan Africa is that if they grow grain, they don't feed it to the cattle. They're eating it.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, that you need to get to the point where you can grow a lot more grain, can grow a lot more food. And, you know, also very importantly, you can keep that food from spoiling. A huge problem in those poorer countries is not just the fact that, you know, you're not as efficient when it comes to growing food, because you may not have the incredible road network we have, the train network, the transportation network you have here in the United States. Getting that food from the farmer to a market, a lot more challenging. You lose a lot. That's inefficient as well. So you can see how once you start to try to get at this kind of problem, it has so many different challenges. You know, it's not just about helping out the farmer directly. It's about making sure the road network works so we can safely get it from him to the consumer. You know, so smart people are working on this. It's going to take, I think, a lot of aid, a lot of money. But, you know, you can make a difference there. And the difference that you can make in a place like sub-Saharan Africa, once you successfully do that, really resound. I mean, it has a multiplying effect that's incredibly important.
Yeah, and I guess I'm wondering, you know, there's no matter what you do today, there's always a political aspect to this. Where are we on that? I mean, there are going to have to be winners and losers. Some people may have to consume less so that others can get what they need. That can be a real tough sell.
I think it's an incredibly tough sell. I mean, it's a tough sell for really anything we want to consume. I mean, whether it's gasoline and oil, whether it's meat, you know. And I don't think you're too likely to get the average American who's thinking of a million things to think, well, I've got to reduce my meat consumption because someone else somewhere in the rest of the world needs to have that. I mean, what we really need to do is figure out a way to sustainably grow that amount. I mean, again, that term that the authors of the paper use, sustainable intensification, because really I think we've proven again and again that sort of limiting solutions, they work for some people, certainly, but like it's not something that seems very effective on a global level for the average person. So figure out a way to grow that pie larger rather than saying, all right, you can only have so much and this person needs that other amount.
Did you get any sense from this report and this research that there was the clock was ticking, that we had maybe a deadline or of any kind? I mean, we hear about that a lot when we talk about climate change and things like that. What about feeding ourselves? Are we headed for any kind of a cliff here of any kind?
You know, it's always possibly true. You know, but we when it comes to feeding ourselves in the rich world, we have so much more food than we need, and that's where we are in the planet. Really, we're in this very interesting situation where we're sort of stuck. stuffed and starved is the term. There's a huge part of the planet, not just in the rich world, but increasingly in the growing developing world, that has too much food, or certainly consumes too much food to an unhealthy degree. But while you have that, you still have that 1.3 billion people who don't get enough. So I think, you know, there's got to be a way to figure out, you know, we have enough food out there to feed people. The question is, how do we get more of that food to the developing world? How do we get it to being grown in the developing world so it evens out to a much greater degree? And then we can also look at, well, what do we in the rich world need to do for our diet? And I think, again, probably less for the global environmental footprint than for our own health. You know, it's definitely not healthy for us to be as obese as so many Americans and so many people in the rich world are. So that's something we can do almost simultaneously. But it does sort of point out how challenging this is when one part of the planet is stuffed, the other part of the planet is starved. How do you find solutions that work for both?
Well, and I mean, there's also an element of an issue of fairness here. I mean, the rich world are asking the poor countries to change their ways. How much help are we offering?
You know, not enough, I think. And you know, when it comes to climate change, for instance, and just the issue of greenhouse gas emissions, you know, we have these UN summits every year where all the countries meet and try to come up with some kind of global allocation, some kind of global deal when it comes to how much greenhouse gas emissions, you know, the United States or the rich world can do, how much the developing world can produce. And we failed over and over again to come to that solution because people don't want to accept limits. You know, countries don't want to accept limits. And certainly a fast-growing developing nation where people are suddenly getting into the point where they can have some meat, they can maybe have a motorcycle or a car, it's not fair to tell them that they can't have that, I think, even though those sort of changing countries are going to be where the vast bulk of new emissions, the vast bulk of new consumption is going to be coming from. So that's where, you know, again, where I come back to just realistically, we need to figure out a way to do it much, much, much more efficiently. And again, grow that pie, but do it in a way that doesn't choke us all.
And I think that's a great place to leave it. Brian Walsh, thank you very much for being on with me this morning for a very informative hour.
Thank you very much.
Brian Walsh, senior editor of Time Magazine, author of the story, The Triple Whopper Environmental Impact of Global Meat Production. Robin Cherry produced this hour programming on the Ideas Network. Christy Taylor was my director, and Robin also handled on-air production. Thank you very much to both of them. Coming up at this time tomorrow, we'll find out where to go in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan to enjoy the scenery and outdoor activities. I've got a few ideas. I've been there. You can go there too, and you can tell me where to go. Why not? I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.